Hey there, CNFers. Hope you're having a CNFing good week. My oh my. Where do we start? Maybe if you're new to the podcast, I should let you know what it's about. This is the show where I speak to the world's best artists about creating works of nonfiction. Leaders in narrative journalism, like Susan Orlean. Personal essay, like Matthew Mercier. Memoir, like Pulitzer Prize winner Madeline Blaze. Radio, like Joe Donahue. And documentary film like Jeff Krulik and Penny Lane. As of now, it's mainly writers, but I'm scurrying like heck to get more filmmakers and radio producers on the show. It's my job to tease out origins, habits, routines, and points of craft so that you can apply those tools of mastery to your own work. I also hope that in having these conversations, you might also not feel as lonely or alone in your artistic pursuits. You'll notice every single guest has more or less the same set of anxieties that you have, and they manage to get the work done, and great work at that. So I deal with my own self-hatred and lack of worth from the moment my alarm goes off at 4 a.m. So there you have it. If you have a similar feeling, know that you're not alone. So in any case, today's guest is Cy Montgomery, and you probably know her from her gargantuan bestseller, The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the World of Consciousness. It was a National Book Award finalist, and just one of the literally dozens of books Cy has written about animals. In this episode, we talk about how Cy got her start as a business writer, of all things, in Buffalo, New York, belief in projects, even when you don't believe in yourself, being open to your expectations of a story changing as you go, and much, much more. Frankly, I came away from this conversation just feeling good, just good. And the people who make you feel that way are the people you want to surround yourself with. And I know I ended that last sentence with a preposition, but whatever. So before I send you off into the animal kingdom with Cy, here's that part where I ask you to leave an honest, not even a positive, just an honest review on iTunes. Any review posted from now through the end of the year gets an hour-long editorial consult from me, which includes this kind of questionnaire I send out, but also then I will edit and really crunch down on about 2,000 words of your work, which is about a $50 value if you like putting dollars and cents on things. Simply send me a screenshot of your review and I'll reach out. My pile of editorial stuff is growing thanks to you. Reviews are the currency we play with now, so to reach more people and empower them to do the kind of work they find most inspiring, these reviews help the podcast be more visible to those people, like yourself. All right, that was a bit long, I know, but let's do the show, let's do it, let's just get right into it. Here is Cy really cool Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
As we're getting towards the end of the year here, at the beginning of the year, let me just back up a little bit. At the beginning of the year, I was talking to a lot of people on the podcast about how they were setting up their year, kind of like those New Year's resolution type things, to so they'd have a good year. And now we're 11 months later, and I wonder, like, how do you process or maybe review the year that you've had, and then maybe setting the table to have a good 2018? Like, how are you processing this time of year?
Well, this year, I have been dealing with six books at once, and that's too much. And yeah. I don't want to do that anymore, because you feel like you're running out into the street in your bathrobe catching a taxi to the airport every minute. It's terrible. And I've had lots of experience loving researching, and I always love the research, but I don't always love the writing part. And when you're writing with a gun to your head, you really don't like it. So I have had a hard time enjoying writing with so many deadlines and so many, you know, and you look up and there's another one looming on the horizon.
Yeah.
So this is insane. So I'm not going to do that anymore. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, I've been doing this full time, working for myself since gosh, 5 years out of college, you'd think I would have gotten the hang of it. But no, I say yes too much, because I love all the stuff that I work on, and I consider it, you know, not only is it a joy, but it's a, you know, my husband kids me, I'm doing the octopus ministry now, you know, because my last book was all about octopus. Yeah. But, you know, I'm doing stuff that I deeply believe in, and I think, you know, it is an honor for me to be part of the movement that is, I think, changing people's relationship with the rest of animate creation. I really think that's happening right now, and I'm thrilled to be part of it. But anyway, I just can't say yes like I've been doing for the past couple of years. So I'm switching to let me check my calendar.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, instead of a yes, I'll have it. How about yesterday? That'll work great. You know. But there's, you know, with Soul of an Octopus, that book did very well. It's now, and it's, let's see, it's got, we just sold Spanish, so that's 12 languages.
Wow.
And you feel like, oh my gosh, it's my 15 minutes of fame. I've got to say yes to everything, because I'm never going to get an opportunity like this. That business part of it too is actively working. And, but then I'm going to turn 60 in February. As much as I love my writing and research, I also love the little town I live in. I love Thurber, my puppy. I love my husband, who is also a writer, Howard Mansfield. I love it all. And I just have to slow down a little bit. So that's my goal.
Yeah.
For 2018.
Now, are these six book projects that you've got, in production, is this really like a direct result of the success of Soul of an Octopus?
Well, you can't really tell. You can't really tell. But you do kind of think that if you've got a national bestseller, that you're flavor of the month for a little bit. So I pitched all of these things. It wasn't like people came to me on their knees, oh, please write this book. But I pitched them, and I pitched them pretty fast. So the six books that are, you know, on their way in some point of the Python, you know, some of them are fixing. One of them's coming out this spring, a book on hyenas. I've got another book coming out for little kids on Inky the Octopus, mm-hmm. The real octopus who went down the drain and escaped back to his original sea home in New Zealand. And then in the fall, I have another book, which is a memoir called How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. That's coming out in the fall. And I just Monday pressed send on a book on wildebeest. That's, you know, the first draft is done, and I sent to my editor. And last month I got back from the first of two expeditions to California for a California condor book. And then I've got a giant manta ray book that we're still in the planning stages of, you know, doing the research. And but goodness, you know, I haven't been diving. I haven't been scuba diving in a couple of years, actually. Huh. And for this, I'm going to need to scuba dive. So, and you can't just hope you're going to remember as you go over the boat, you know. So I need to have some time brushing up on those skills. And oh gosh, I don't know what else is in production. I mean, I counted it up and there were six. So I mean, there were so many that I wasn't even keeping track of them. And it was one of those things that I can always tell when I've got too much going on, when I smack my head against hard objects frequently, not on purpose, but you know, you're like whacking your head as if you can't remember, what is it my neck ends in again? Oh yeah, it's my head. So when you're getting in the car and you smack your head, and when you're going down the basement, you smack your head, it's kind of like someone slapping you and saying, get a hold of your life.
Wow. So, all right. So before we get to how, then maybe how you're like peeling back from a lot of that work, I want to say, like, you've got those, you've got those projects going in the hopper in various forms of completion. So this past, you know, maybe year and a half, 2 years that you've taken on a lot of this work, how have you been juggling that? And how have you been setting up your days so you can, you know, hit send and meet your deadlines? Like, how have you been doing that?
Well, you know, I was trained as a journalist, and right out of, well, in college, I worked for a daily paper, so every day you had a deadline. So you just don't miss a deadline. And it also helped that my father was an Army general. So discipline was a big thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't miss deadlines. It just doesn't happen. It's not an option. Now, you know, if the Kakapo is not nesting that year, you can't do the book, so you're not going to make that deadline. Or, you know, if the researcher broke her foot, so you can't do the Altai Mountains looking for the snow leopard, well, that's different. But I always make the deadlines, and so that's always priority one. And it really helps to be married to a writer who totally understands that. He actually Howard hired me on the college newspaper, and totally understands deadlines, totally understands the writing life. So everything in our life, you know, we purposely did not have children. However, we have a border collie, and I am now taking him to dance lessons. So go figure that one out.
That's amazing.
Well, he's a genius, and you know, he's making it to his play dates. He's making it to his lessons. But you know, I guess there's a lot of stuff that I don't do with my life that that other people do. You know, I don't have to pick out what I'm going to wear in the morning or put on makeup or even comb my hair. I work at home. I live in a little rural town where, you know, you expect there's going to be chicken shit on the bottom of your shoes. And there's a lot of stuff that we don't have to worry about. That's kind of how you do it. And I'm pretty good about, I mean, in the morning, usually, I mean, today is an exception, but most of the time, if the phone rings in the morning, I don't pick it up. In fact, I often just don't even have the ringer on. I don't check my email usually in the morning when I'm actively writing something. The writing is everything. That's what you do. And everything else comes after that. Now, that's kind of not true, because the very first thing I do in the morning is I give Thurber an hour-long walk in the woods. But that's really good for your brain.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Like, there are untold volumes of essays and good work of writers just waxing poetic about the need for walking as a way, as part of the writing process.
Yeah, I think it's a great way to sort things out, and also just, you know, to be in the woods with an animal who you love is great for me. It's great for me because it's real, you know. This is as real as it gets, and it tethers you to, well, it tethers me to why I do what I do, because what I'm trying to be in my writing is a servant to the rest of animate creation.
Yeah.
And here is one of the emissaries, my joyous, intelligent, emotional, delighted dog right there, reminding me who else is out there and who's counting on folks like me to be their spokesperson.
And when you were, you've been doing this kind of, you know, journalism, freelancing, and so forth since 5 years out of college. Is when you were hanging your shingle at that point, so to speak, did you have this type of naturalist writing, this advocacy for animal intelligence and animate creation from the get-go, or is this something you sort of slowly folded into over the years?
Oh, it was definitely from the get-go. But you know, when you get out of college, you got to take whatever job there is, And I actually started working for the Buffalo Evening News, and I was a business writer. I didn't know anything about business. My first story was writing about potholes in parking lots. And so I worked for them for a while, but I knew the job I wanted. I wanted to work for the Courier News in Bridgewater, New Jersey, New Jersey being the state with the highest number per capita of scientists and engineers, because I wanted to write about science. I wanted to write about environment, and I was also interested in medicine. And that was the job that I got after working at the Courier News for 1 year as an area reporter. Then I got to be the science environmental writer. So, and I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And then after like 4 years on the job, I took a vacation with Earthwatch, which pairs paying laymen with scientific projects around the world. And my father gave me a ticket to Australia, and I decided I didn't want to just go vacation there. I wanted to work there for an environmental project. So that's where Earthwatch came in. I worked on a project with Dr. Pamela Parker of Brookfield Conservation Park, studying the southern hairy-nosed wombat. And after 2 weeks of living in the field, studying these beautiful animals, I knew that I didn't want to go back and work at the newspaper anymore. This is what I wanted to do full time. So I quit my job and got a tent and moved to the outback and studied emus.
Wow.
And I had no money. I was not paid for it. My airfare was not paid for, but Pamela Parker paid for my food. I mean, she gave me food that she had on hand for her research park, and I basically had no expenses. So that's what I did, and I lived in a tent for 6 months and followed emus around, finding out what they did all day. And even though, you know, I loved my job at the Courier News, and I'm still friends with a lot of the folks that I worked with, and they're very talented, and they treated me really well, and I had, you know, grown a great deal there and had been given a lot of freedom. But after that, I knew that I really needed to work for myself. And my husband and I moved to New Hampshire because it had more tree cover and more of its original wetlands than any other place that we could find near a major metropolitan area, which was Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And we both started freelancing. I mean, we were out on a limb. Everyone said, "You're nuts." Everybody told me, "You're insane," because I had this great, job, and I was given all of these nice raises, and I had a lot of freedom within the job. But this was what I wanted to do. And you know, so often we writers are told when we do what we believe in that we're crazy, and that you really should pick a safer option, and yada yada, and I have never picked the safe option, and I have never regretted choosing what I've chosen, ever.
Wow. So what gave you and your husband the courage to do that and to be those full-time freelancers and to, you know, deal with those ups and downs that comes with, you know, hanging your shingle as a freelancer? How did you guys weather that? What were some of those early growing pains too?
Well, early on, you know, my husband worked in a bookstore for part of the time. He worked in the post office. I worked shoveling horse shit in a stable, which of course for me was very honorable work. I loved being with the horses.
Yeah.
I was honored to do that for them. And you know, my friends were horrified. But I liked doing that. And Howard's time in the bookstore was also extremely useful. I mean, now we have a very close connection with the bookstore, but that's because they're selling our books.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband and I both understanding what it means to be a writer, I think, was really key. If we had any other mate, it would have been far more difficult, unless, of course, one of us had sense enough to marry like an astrophysicist or a doctor or a banker or something like that.
Right.
But far more than having enough money to live. And really, you know, we can live on very little money. Howard and I, we both feel like we have everything we want. We have too many things. We never, like, want some other thing. I mean, you want new food every week because you ate the last food. But, you know, what else could you possibly want in the world? There's just stuff everywhere. And if you don't wash your clothes that often, they last forever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're very happy. Healthcare was always interesting in the beginning because we didn't have any insurance, but we were young, so nothing weird happened, although I kept flinging myself into jungles where – but here was the thing. I mean, very early on I got dengue fever, for example, when I was in Borneo researching my first book. But even if I'd had money, I was in the middle of nowhere. I couldn't have afforded – I mean, I couldn't have found a doctor even if I could have afforded one. So with a lot of these things, you either, like, die, in which case, well, you don't have any problems, or you get better. But, you know, as far as just having the courage to do what you want to do, what I would say about that, I just, it's not that hard to do unless you've already tied yourself down to a whole lot of things or some other kind of life. I mean, if you've got 10 children and a mortgage, that's going to make a different kind of life for you. But we didn't have that. We knew what we wanted, and it was not that hard to have it. The hard part, of course, was getting rejections. It wasn't the money or the insurance so much, but it is hard as a writer getting, you know, pitching your stuff all the time, and of course you're going to have rejections.
Yeah. How did you deal with rejections and self-doubt that inevitably creeps in? If you're big projects, getting rejected on big projects, if it's that one feels like a gut punch because you put a lot into it, then there's some of that mercenary work that sometimes you can get a rejection one day and then send it out the next day and get an acceptance. So, like, how did you deal with sort of those little micro rejections and macro rejections and then still have the strength to keep going?
I don't always believe in myself. I can't just believe in myself because I'm not that great. But I do believe in my project.
Mm.
You know, I do believe in my animal teachers, my human teachers, I believe in the experience that I've had. And so when that gets rejected, I'm looking at, you know, can I learn something from that rejection to make that experience, to fulfill what I owe that experience? That way you don't feel like you personally have been rejected, because I think that makes people's ears and tail go down, and then they want to crawl into a hole and die like a rat who had poison. But when I've always had complete confidence in my teachers and my message, so I've never lost faith in that. I just need to be a better messenger, and sometimes the rejections can help you be a better messenger. Other times you just have to ignore those people because there's no accounting for taste, you know. Oh, that dress makes you look fat. Well, maybe it doesn't make you look fat. it's just people's taste and that person's individual taste on that particular day. But still, just like a focus group, you can take a look at what those people who rejected your story said. Why did they reject it? And can you make it better by addressing something? Then look at them as somebody who's helping you, someone who's being useful to you.
Right. That's real important. The that you mentioned, that the other person's taste on the other line is it's a intersection of maybe what they've already published, what they've already accepted, timing, and even mood for that given day. You just
right.
There's
right.
so many.
When
things.
Did they eat? Were they hungry? When they, you know, and
yeah.
they found that judges' verdicts are remarkably different right before lunch and right after lunch. You could have committed the exact same crime, but if the judge decides what to do with you right before lunch, you're going to get a much more severe sentence.
Oh my, that's encouraging.
I know. So I mean, take your editor out to lunch.
Yes,
that's my advice.
Yes, give him a delicious sandwich, a healthy side, some sparkling water. So, as you were developing the stories that really resonated with your personal taste, these projects that you, even if they were getting rejected, like you deeply believed in, what did those stories look like, and like how, and what was, how were you advocating for them? So eventually, you were getting more of those acceptances to allow you to do the work that you felt most strongly about.
Well, sometimes it just meant that I had to kind of switch the form. Very early, I started writing books, but continued to write magazine articles and newspaper articles and stuff like that, kind of to finance the books and to forward the research. Often I would just find an editor with whom I clicked, and we would discuss the assignment together so that we were both on the same page and could go forward, and then I would stick with that. You know what I mean? That was a big help. But you know, I have had some kind of dramatic setbacks. My first book, Walking with the Great Apes, which is about Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, and Brigitte Galdikas, the first three ladies to study humankind's closest relatives, and that book is still in print. When I first sold it, I think it was to McGraw-Hill or something. And I had gone to Borneo, where I got dengue fever, and I'd put a lot of research into it already. I came home from the trip and discovered that the publisher was no longer selling trade books, and they had canceled my contract.
Mm.
It had nothing to do with my work. But I was screwed. This was bad. So my agent, who I didn't know very well, she and I are very good friends now. She's been my agent from the start. And I were thinking, well, we have to sell it somewhere else. Well, my best friend, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who's considerably older and more experienced than I am and was a multi-bestseller, had her editor over for lunch, Peter Davison, who was the poetry editor for The Atlantic, and he had his own imprint at Houghton Mifflin. And she told Peter about me. And my agent the next day sent over my book proposal to Peter. And he accepted that thing and gave me way more of an advance than I'd had from McGraw-Hill.
Huh.
And it worked out being a great thing. But let me tell you, I was you know, feeling like I was hanging over a volcano by a hair-thin thread, because I'd already put so much into that book, and then all of a sudden it wasn't even going to be published. So, and I've had all kinds of things go incredibly wrong. You know, when I went to India and Bangladesh, my first expedition for Spell of the Tiger, as soon as I got to India, which was where I was going to do most of my research, I discovered that my scientist, my translator, and my engineer, speedboat operator, all fell through.
Hmm.
And when I got myself out to the mangrove swamp where the man-eating tigers lived, then civil war essentially broke out in India. Martial law was declared, and people were burning other people alive, and it was just a big mess. And I was stuck out in this border area on the border of Bangladesh, and I couldn't get out of there, and no one else could go in there. And there I was without a translator, and everyone speaking Bengali. It was a big problem. But almost without exception, every one of these horrendous problems worked out to be a tremendous help. What happened to me in, when everything fell through in India was that instead of hearing the scientist's story of what was going on, I got to be very good friends with the villagers. And when I went back, and I went back a second time and a third time and even a fourth time, and I got a story that no one else could have ever gotten because no one was listening to what these villagers knew. Mm. Everyone was dismissing them, and they probably weren't particularly eager to tell it to some big deal government official or, you know, because of the caste system and everything. Whereas they were delighted to tell an author. The Bengalis have an incredible literary history and love for literature of all kinds, to the point that these people who were certainly not wealthy. A lot of them did not own any shoes. They didn't have running water. Their houses were made of mud. They asked me in Bengali to recite Shakespeare in English for them. They knew who our Shakespeare was.
Mm.
And then they would recite Rabindranath Tagore and their great Bengali poets in Bengali for me. They were so respectful of the fact that I was writing a book that they wouldn't let me put my notebook on the ground.
Huh.
Because it was disrespectful to the book. So, I mean, that was incredible. The opportunity that I had, and I had that opportunity because my original plans were swept away.
That's right. It kind of goes to how the whole making lemonade from lemons, like the with the Borneo book, it looked like it was dead, but it just through sheer endurance and just having the right, you know, making the right connection, that eventually gets greenlit to something better than a better deal than before. And then with this experience in India, it looks like your original plan was toast. But what came after, just by sticking around and keeping your antenna tuned to the story or to what's happening around you, it turned into something probably better than you could have ever imagined. So,
absolutely.
Like what did those experiences just kind of like teach you about the nature of just kind of hanging around and letting things unfold and then just being open to it?
Well, you pretty much named it. I mean, when you're doing nonfiction, you have to let the story speak to you. And often when you're doing what I do, if you're talking to people who live close to the earth, for example, they may tell you things that at first seem impossible. I did another book called Journey of the Pink Dolphins. And people told me that these dolphins were very difficult to study, by the way. They lived in either very dark or very opaque water. They don't leap out of the water like oceanic dolphins do. These are river dolphins. So they're very hard to study. They're hard to even see. Well, the local people would tell me stories about how these dolphins turn into people. And they'll come out of the water. And they'll show up at dances, and they will seduce you. And they would tell me that this had happened to them. And they would tell me that, you know, in the morning, you wake up, and your lover has given you a beautiful watch or a lovely necklace, and you look on the night table, and your lover is gone, and the jewelry they gave you has turned to a pile of silvery fish. And this would happen to me in West Bengal, in India as well. People would tell me, oh, the tigers, they can become invisible here. The tigers can fly through the air. They would tell me that when a tiger kills a man, when the tiger picks them up, the corpse shrinks to half its size in the tiger's jaws. And I'm writing all this down. I'm listening very carefully to this, and I am not judging it. What I'm doing is listening for their truth. And this is what you do when you fling yourself at nonfiction. You, of course, are forced, unfortunately, to have a preconception because you have to write these stupid book proposals saying, this is what I'm going to find out, which is just an exercise in garbage as far as I'm concerned. And I hate it that we have to do that. But you got to be open to it being a completely different thing and let it sweep you off your feet like you've fallen in love. And listen to the new truth that you're going to hear, that maybe you're hearing for the first time. Maybe no one else has heard that truth. Maybe you're the one that gets to bring that truth to readers all around the world. And that has happened to me.
Wow. That's incredible. And when you're out in the field doing your reporting, do you rely on a recorder at all, or are you just strictly pen and notebook?
Well, I've had some bad things happen. I really, really did have an orangutan eat my interview tapes in Borneo. It was horrible. And so even when I tape an interview, I also write everything out verbatim. And the other thing that I have learned is to duplicate things whenever you possibly can. And, you know, I started doing all of this before there was anything like an internet. And I normally don't carry a computer with me because ants are going to get in there, or it's going to fall in the water, or Wolverine's going to pee on it. You know? So
the usual things reporters are dealing with.
Right. So I try to keep things simple, and also a lot of times I have to carry things kind of a long way. I'm just so glad I'm not a photographer, and I work with wonderful photographers sometimes, but boy, do they have to schlep a lot of stuff, and I'm so glad I just have like a little notebook and a pencil. It's so much easier. But it's also a lot easier, you know, to be taking notes while you're hiking in the Altai Mountains of the Gobi Desert, or lately, you know, I've been doing some scuba stuff, and I have a scuba slate that you can actually take notes underwater, but that's very hard to do, I've got to say, because of when you put on your mask, it distorts your vision, and also just by touching your slate the wrong way, you can wipe out all of your notes.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, but I just kind of keep it simple. And at the end of every day, what I do, even though it's the last thing you want to do, at the end of every day, I try to write in a journal, longhand, not just what happened that day, like Dear Diary, but a little essay about what that day showed me, or what the theme of the day was. Sometimes there is no theme, but often there is one.
Right. That's real valuable. That just adds extra sort of texture to whatever like hard stuff you're able to gather, and you almost give it a beating heart that it might not ordinarily have if you were just like writing down like bullet facts and some quotes,
right.
I guess.
And I often take directly verbatim from my journal. I mean, not just a sentence or a phrase, but largely whole paragraphs. Sometimes the stuff you write in your journal is the best stuff you're going to write. And you think not, because you hurt your hand on a stick, or you know, you really needed to get those 100 pepper ticks out of your leg first, but you instead wrote what you needed to do, or you know, your sleeping bag got wet and you're not very comfortable, but write the journal first. Always put that first.
Wow. Yeah, that's. I'm just picturing these, you know, a leg full of ticks, and you're like, nah, I gotta write in the journal first, then I'll worry about picking these things off my body.
I'll make an exception for leeches. Leeches have to come off before anything else.
And you said earlier how you really like sink yourself and love the research, and the writing is kind of the agonizing part, and that's
it can be, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's great. But sometimes it is like pulling teeth.
Yeah. So how do you, because the research part can be, it's sort of a fine line between doing too much to avoid the writing or doing just enough, doing the research that you need to do to write the thing. But then sometimes you can get lost in wormholes as a form of productive procrastination. So as someone who really loves the research, how do you know when you're done and it's ready to, you're like, all right, Cy, I got to start writing.
Well, often my research is largely in the field, and the field expedition is over and you're out of money, so you so you have to write and you have a deadline. So that's how I stop the research, because most of my stuff, this is the order in which I usually do things. I usually do most of the book research and academic type interviews before I even go into the field.
Mm.
So I have all that loaded into my brain, ready to be surprised. Ready to know, like, oh my gosh, what I just witnessed isn't in the literature. Or, oh geez, this is exactly what David told me that I would see. Or, this reminds me of the thing that Jane wrote about in 1960 about a different species over here. So then I go into the field, and then I come back from the field and I try to start writing as soon as I can. Now, not everything works like this. When I did Soul of an Octopus, the field mostly was going to the New England Aquarium every Wednesday. But I knew when I had finished. I knew when I had finished that book. That book had a very clear point at which I was ending. Mm. And that turned out to be when the giant ocean tank, which was complete. I mean, I didn't plan it this way, but when I started my research on Soul of an Octopus, it's a book about transformation. I mean, who's more transformational than an octopus who can change color and shape and pour their body through a tiny opening, right?
Yeah.
But at the time I was researching this book on transformation, the whole aquarium was transforming itself, and its central pillar, the giant ocean tank, was being redone.
Yeah.
So when it reopened and had remade itself, I knew that was when the book would end with that. And it also kind of had to simultaneously end with the death of one of the octopuses who had been very important to me. So I knew when that was going to end, but that's when I stopped going to the field. But usually I plan these things so that I do the book and interview research. I then do the field research. I come home and bang, I write it.
Hmm. Was that refreshing in a sense when you were doing Soul of an Octopus, that the structure kind of revealed itself in the construction of that new great ocean tank?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I was so lucky with that book. Man, I was unbelievably blessed. Wilson Menashe, who's the Octopus Enrichment guy and one of my close friends now, he constantly says to me, you know, you could not have written that book today. Because the things that were going on, the people who were there, the whole setup for being with the octopuses, none of that had ever happened before, and things have been so remade that it never will happen again in that way. So I just let the octopuses lead me. I just let the story completely take me and sweep me away, and all I had to do was see what the story was. It was laid out for me.
Yeah.
And that has happened over and over and over. And this is why I just hate having to write these stupid book proposals. I think of them as a selling tool, and I understand why the publishers have to have them, because they want to know that six other books just like this one sold great. Okay, so you can just see my disdain for having to do this, and I also find it personally insulting. But because, gosh, don't you trust me now? I've written 23 books or 24 books.
Yeah.
But anyway, it just ain't the way it used to be. But you just got to be open to the sweep of the story and be free to let yourself go with it and be surprised and be educated and be delighted and experience the sorrow. And I mean, that's the joy of nonfiction. And it probably is the joy of fiction too. I just don't know how to write fiction, so I don't know what that's like.
And do you go into a project, say, taking Soul of an Octopus as an example, like when you started that, did you basically not know
you know, may you knew basically, oh yes, an octopus has eight arms, and that's kind of all I know. And then you go in and then just totally write what you don't know, so that way you're open to learning the whole thing. Or do you sometimes go in with, oh, I have a general understanding, but I'd love to just take a deep dive with some experts,
so to like, speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Good metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, what's your starting point typically with those?
I did know that octopuses were smart. And the whole reason I chose octopus was that here is a mollusk. You know, mollusks are snails. Mollusks are clams. Clams do not even have brains. Here is a mollusk who is smart. Here is a marine invertebrate, which is what most of animals are on the planet, who is smart. Can I get to know someone like this? And if so, what are they like? Do they have consciousness? What is consciousness? So I knew when I walked through the doors of New England Aquarium with an assignment from which I had pitched to Orion Magazine, I knew that that there could be some very rich material there. I didn't know what it was. And I also did not know that I could become friends with an octopus. But the minute I met Athena, the minute this intelligent creature looked me in the eye, her eye swiveled in its socket, locked on my face. And she slid over from her lair and she changed color with emotion. I mean, she felt something about coming over to see me, and I could see it on her skin. I could see her attention riveted on me. I could see the curiosity of this animal. How many people have that experience with any marine creature, other than maybe a dolphin or, you know, a sea turtle? But how many people even experience that with a fish? But how many people experience that with a mollusk? And so I knew this is about consciousness. This is about intelligence. This is about the nature of our souls. And I knew it was the most important book that I could write at this time in my career. And I knew also that I had been working up to writing about invertebrates for a long time. My first book, you know, being about Walking with the Great Apes, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, Brute Galdikas, and the animals who are so closely related to us, you can get a blood transfusion from a chimp. You know, I knew that these are animals who are easy for people to relate to, and particularly when I'm standing on the shoulders of these giant women, these great leaders in ethology, at a time when women in science was a kind of hot new thing. And from there, I continued to write about large vertebrate animals. I wrote about tigers, and I wrote about dolphins, and I've written about birds, and I wrote about my relationship with my pig, who was a great big Buddha master, you know, that kind of thing. But I knew all this time that if I got wise enough and if I was able to find the right teachers, that I would love to write about invertebrates, because most of us here on Earth are invertebrates and no one writes about them. No one knows anything about them.
Yeah. And why do you think that it connected so strongly with people, the soul of an octopus?
Wow, I'm not sure. My husband's even more unsure. I think if he'd been hit on the head with a meteor, he couldn't have been more surprised than how well this book did. But people, I don't know. I do think that people are interested in other minds now in a way that they haven't been in the past. And it's something that I've been working toward along with a lot of my colleagues and friends, like, well, Jane Goodall, Barbara King, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, tons of Sue Savage Rumbaugh, Brenda Peterson. I could just keep on naming Diane Ackerman. A lot of women, aren't they?
Yeah.
But there's been a lot of interest lately that I think has been building for a long time. And I don't think it's anything I did, to be frank. I think it's what the zeitgeist, and I think it's what these individual animals who I knew gave me. They gave me so much of themselves when they gave me their friendship, and their friendship was irresistible.
Who were, as you know, you've written so many books, and who were people early on, and then even as you progressed, that you found yourself reading or rereading, and also writers that you might have like modeled yourself after as you were trying to develop your own voice?
Well, my favorite writer of all time is a guy I married. Is Howard Mansfield. He is, and his talent is so much greater than mine. He writes about totally different things. Although we both are trying to kind of hold the world together, he writes about preservation. He writes about the souls of towns and of buildings and of streets and of houses. He writes about what museums have to tell us. At heart, we sort of are writing about the same thing, but I'm writing about the animal world, and he's writing about the human world. So I've always been one of his first readers, and he's always one of my first readers, and I've learned a lot from him. My best friend is Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who is an incredible writer. I grew up reading Farley Moat. I grew up reading people who understood that animals had thoughts and feelings and minds, you know, like Hope Ryden. I read everything Jane Goodall ever wrote. I read everything. Well, Diane Fossey wrote a beautiful book, Gorillas in the Mist. And Birute Galdikas wrote her books after I wrote mine, I think. But her books are beautiful, too. But I do mostly, with the exception of Howard, I mostly read about animals and about the natural world. I recently read that wonderful book, The Hidden Life of Trees.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That knocked my socks off.
Well, you talk
but
about
the world
some...
is just... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, you talk about, you know, these animals like mollusks in an octopus that you didn't... You know, that most people didn't realize have consciousness and feeling and even and memory. And so, like, you're reading Peter Wohlleben's Hidden Life of Trees. Like, there's another thing, like, do the you know, plants, they'll, well, the trees, they'll help out an injured tree. Like, if there's a tree cut down, they don't know it's cut down. They know it's hurt. They'll funnel resources to it. So it's like,
right.
That's kind of goes right to what you're doing. You're sort of just peeling back the levels of, you know, what we understand these, you know, giving a greater sense of sort of consciousness and mindfulness to things that we often think, oh, well, they're subordinate to us, so they can't possibly have this degree of, you know, sentient thought or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's a wonderful quote attributed to Thales of Miletus, and it goes like this. It says, "The universe is alive and has fire in it, and it's full of gods." And to me, that's what I get to be learning in my research, that the world is far more animate and far more exciting and far more holy than most of us might at first imagine.
And so you mentioned a lot of great writers there, your husband included. What are some books that you find yourself revisiting over and over again, just to try to see how they're working and get into their bones a bit?
Well, you know, I kind of don't look behind the curtain when I read.
Mm.
I just let it sweep me along. And I think it just seeps into you. I mean, maybe this is just me being lazy. But the cadences of the Bible, for example, when I was growing up, were part of my literary tradition very much. And also, as a public speaker, I do a lot of speaking now, and a lot of the preachers that I met in church were really helpful. My father was a general, and he would be called upon to give speeches as well. But whether it's speech or whether you're reading it, I think it just kind of seeps into your body, and you feel like what you're absorbing is the story, but it's also the language at the same time. But the language, a lot of times the best language is just completely transparent, as you know. My husband reads poetry in the mornings. He's reading a lot of Elizabeth Bishop these days, which is a lovely way to start your morning. But, I mean, my poetry is walking in the woods with my dog, Thurber.
Yeah, and how have you cultivated a sense of maybe like of patience in your work over the years to let things unfold as they can, especially when you're young? You know, you want to, like, you're hungry for that toehold and that validation. And I wonder, like, when you were getting started, and how were you able to be patient enough to let that toehold come when it came, and then how did you just manage to run your own race and just get those early victories to snowball you towards where you are now?
Well, I certainly was very nervous. I mean, you have this feeling that you can fail your destiny. You know, I had all of these wonderful animals that were helping me, and what if I just wasn't good enough and was going to fail them? And I felt that all the time. I felt so nervous about it all the time. And I wish I could go back and tell my young self that you do have to work really hard, but it's not you that's going to succeed. What's going to succeed is the message that you get to hear. You know what I mean? It's kind of like not about you. You have to work your tail off, but it's that pure message that's going to eventually get through. Trust your teachers, trust your material, trust your message. And if you just work hard at it, you will succeed. Just like you want to be a great concert pianist, well, it's easy. All you have to do is practice every day for 5 hours. That may not be true. I mean, there's also some degree of talent, but I certainly know I am no more talented than anyone else. Just lucky.
Yeah, and well, luck comes to those who put in the work and they're prepared, and the opportunity intersects with the hard work. And a concert pianist is a great sort of analogy. Like when they play their scales over and over again. And I wonder how would you define writer scales, and what does hard work look like for you so that you've done hard work and then you can be ready for when the opportunity strikes?
Oh, that is a very smart question. Well, the hard work means, you know, covering all the bases. If you're doing research, just leave no stone unturned. Wait until you're getting the same answer over and over and over again. Don't quit early, and be creative about all the bases, you know, covering all of those bases. The other advice I would have for people, and this has gone a hell of a long way for me, is just be really courteous to all of your sources, because they'll want to talk to you again. They'll want to help you if you're super courteous, and if you send them the article that you wrote, or if you, you know, fact check the thing with them and make sure that everything is correct. Just simple courtesy and doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it goes a heck of a long way. And then your sources who are helping you are going to call you up with their ideas. They're going to help you in all kinds of, they're going to help give you connections and help you in every way. That's probably the one thing that I've consistently done right, is I've tried to be really courteous, but I think I've somehow just started losing track of what does hard work look like. Sometimes hard work just looks like doing what you said you're going to do when you said you were going to do it.
Mm.
And you would not believe how few people do that these days.
Huh. Why do you think that is? That there's this a tendency to shortchange that thing that sounds so simple on the surface of just holding up your end of the deal, basically.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
It could be as perhaps people are so bombarded with getting peppered with various distractions that sometimes it's easy for an email that you wanted to timely respond to somebody, it starts to move farther and farther down the inbox or just texts and tweets and other kind of notifications that pop up on people's phones and computers that it's like the mind's getting hit from so many angles that perhaps it's just easy to sweep common courtesy under the rug for just to be biting at various sweet treats that just pop in every now and again. I don't have a good answer for that myself. I know that, like you, the only thing I probably have as someone who is not very well known in this line of work is to be courteous and to be timely and not only meet my deadline, but meet it by a week and try to make my editor's job as easy as possible, because I'm just that grateful and grateful for that opportunity. And it sounds like you come from a similar place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think that also kind of prepares your heart to do a good job in the world in general, you know, and
yeah.
it keeps us humble and gratitude keeps us humble. And being grateful, like what you just said, being grateful for this opportunity, I think that fills your whole life. I think it fills your work too, and that's the point that I want to be writing from a point of gratitude.
And do you find that writing about the natural world and animals has reaffirmed your? It gives you that footing of gratitude and sort of that you're, you know, a greater part of the animal kingdom too. Like it kind of, I don't know, gives you more energy than maybe writing about people when you're.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I've always I like people, and you know, I married one and everything, but I'm much more interested in the other. Because it is other.
Mm.
And I love exploring. That doesn't mean I don't love the familiar, but I love to explore. And I find the world gets wider and wider as you see it through other, not just other eyes, but entirely other senses. And that's what animals let you do.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of like when you're walking your dog in the mornings. Like if you just take a peek and look at like the happy smile on your dog's face as you're taking that walk, it like totally imbues the walk with a different set of experiences. It's seeing the world through the dog's eyes, if you will. It's like, wow, this is a pretty lucky and joyous thing I get to do every morning.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Gosh, you know what? I'm going to have to go to the dentist.
I'm glad I can send you off to the dentist. Sai, this was what a pleasure to get to speak to you about your work and octos and other kinds of animals. This was a lot of fun, and maybe when your memoir comes out, we can have you back on and talk a little more shop and how you came to that book.
I would love that.
Brendan,
I'd love to do that. That would be fabulous. I'm going to pass your name on to the publicist and not lose track of you. So this was a real pleasure. Thank you for all your smart questions and your good listening and letting me connect with your listeners.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you. And we will certainly be in touch and keep up the great work, Sai. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Yeah, baby. That's another CNF in conversation in the books. Thanks to Cy Montgomery, at Cy the Author on the Twitters. I'm at Brendan O'Mara on the Twitters. Feel free to reach out with feedback and maybe what you want to hear and maybe what you're even struggling with. That'll help me maybe pinpoint some questions at these people and be like, you know what? These are what is concerning you, so maybe I can ask them, and then they're just going to offer their brilliant insights to how they deal with it. That might help you out, so don't be shy. And if you're feeling froggy and want an extra monthly nugget of goodness, I have a monthly newsletter that I send out on the first of the month with my book recommendations and what you might have missed from the world of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. I plan on adding some extra goodies to the newsletter in 2018, but in the meantime, it's books and pods. Once a month, no spam, and you can't beat it. Have a CNF and good week, friends, and we'll do it again next week with another conversation from the world of creative nonfiction. Thanks for listening.